I want to thank Mark and Rob and John and whoever else helped dig my dad out. My dad was coming in from past the high school this morning. There was a car coming the other way, so my dad, being the gentleman, pulled over to let him by and buried his car in a snowdrift. Which, when I pulled in, I thought of that, and I thought of a similar occurrence that happened to me when I was 18, when I was out at New Year's Eve, supposed to be home at midnight, and it's 2 a.m., and I buried my car in a snowdrift, and I called home, and I think my dad's words were, "You put it in, you get it out." I thought, well, he's 98. I really can't come in and say that to him. So last night, Gail and I were at a fundraising banquet for our hospital, and we sat down beside a lady who retired here from Montreal because she wanted to get away from snow. And of course, this year, and I said, well, at least you don't live on Robson Road. And she says, I live on Robson Road. So I took my parents yesterday down towards Point Pelee, and it is unbelievable. There are houses that you see the roof, and the rest is a snowdrift. There are snowdrifts that are taller than my arm that come up to the road, and you can tell they've brought equipment in and dug out the snow. It's unbelievable. It blows along the lake and collects. The houses act as a natural snow fence. So I'm talking actually this week and next week, because the week after that, unfortunately, I'm going to be in Curacao, and the week after that I will be in Bonaire. So sorry about that. I knew you would be sad, but they've graciously given me 2 weeks in a row, because I won't be back for a few weeks. I'm talking about some things that I have been thinking with and dealing with over a series of years. Every once in a while, I will sit down and write out my thoughts. It tends to be when I have time. And I was looking through a book, and I shared from that a little while ago some thoughts that I had dealing with anger that I wrote in 2010. And it's interesting. I was talking about my idolatry and idols in my life. So we're going to talk again about modern idolatry. So I've mentioned this before. I've been raised in this church. I remember singing downstairs in Sunday school, and it was Murray Lynn who first said to me, "You need glasses." And I said, "Why?" He says, "Well, everybody else can see what's on." It wasn't an overhead at that time. It was these cloth things that had our songs on them, but I couldn't see them. And I've mentioned before, my own family on both sides have been attending this church for 100 years. 1913, my dad's dad started coming here with, she's not here today, Janet Kimmerly's grandfather. And some others who are here have family who were involved with this church at that time. Christianity offers promises. Jesus offers promises, and I've read these verses many times. "Come unto me, all ye who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." And Jesus says, "You will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." And I had to look at my own life, and I'm going to be 60 this year. That was kind of brought home when we were out digging the car out, and John Morgan says to me, "Give me the shovel." I guess I was looking like I was verging on. But it's at odds with my life as I saw I was supposed to live. Now, you need to understand something. As I'm telling you things from my journey and how I interpreted life and how I viewed life, which I don't think is too much different how many people interpret my in their lives and interpret the Christian life. And the Christian life seemed to be that I was forgiven, I was going to go to heaven, but now I had a lot of hard work. to live a holy life, to avoid sin. And it seemed that Christianity was, and I'll use the phrase that I've, not mine, but I've gotten from others, the gospel of sin management. That as Christians, we do certain things to manage the sin in our life, to manage the way we live, to manage my actions. And that's what Christianity was. Yes, I was forgiven, but I was sure going to sin a lot. And this is what you do so that you'd sin less. And I often felt that I failed, and I was living in defeat. And I seemed to be living in defeat all the time, because it just was things recurring that I swore I would never do again. God, I promise I won't ever do that again. And then the other thing that really struck me, and it struck me first as I looked at other people's lives, because it's easier to look at others' lives than to look at your own. But as I looked at my own, I realized I was the same guy inside, but I had different actions on the outside. So maybe I don't view pornography, but I sure had lust inside. Maybe I said money isn't important, but I sure wanted more. Maybe I said I love people, but inside I hated certain people. And Jesus had a name for people like that. And he used that a lot to describe people whose lives kind of looked like mine. And I thought, what is this? Is Christianity just behavioral modification? And then every once in a while, things would boil over in my life or somebody else's life, and we'd read about a Christian leader who was found in, like, really weird stuff, like stuff that I would not want to be involved in. And then things would boil over in my life, and I would blow off the handle over nothing. Or I would do stuff that I had promised that I would never do again. And to me, the answer that I am learning, I won't say I've learned, I am learning, is simple and complex. Simple part is I'm learning to live out of the new heart that Christ put in me at the moment of salvation. He put within me all the resources that I needed for living what he would call a holy life. Why is that simple and complex? Well, it's simple and complex because it's involving realizing that I am not who I should be, and maybe the way I'm doing things isn't the right way. So I've referred to this book a few weeks ago when I spoke, God's at War by Kyle Eidelman. I referred to that book, and Gail yesterday said to me, saw it sitting on the kitchen, we're going away, so we always put together some books to carry. If we were smart, we'd put them on our readers so we wouldn't have to carry them, but we're not smart enough to know how to do that in terms of, you know, putting it on your iPad or whatever. And I still like books because it's hard to underline an iPad. You know, I've tried that. You highlight it and then you turn the page and the highlighter didn't follow. But Gail said, is this a good book? And I said, and I paused and I said, well, it's good if you're willing to look at your life. And too many times I read stuff, or here's another book, read this one, but I read it mainly to reinforce my preconceived ideas about how I should live. And the second part, which was complex, was to learn to quit turning to my old idols. And another author who I really appreciate has used this phrase, less wild lovers, and he calls God the wild lover. I need to learn to quit turning to those for what God says he will provide for me. So, Exodus 20 talks about idolatry. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourselves an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. And if this is a little familiar, I did mention this We spoke on this a few weeks ago, but I'm going to review it just for a moment. No other gods before me. That's the first commandment, and those were the Ten Commandments. That's the first one. You shall have no other gods before me. And it doesn't mean in rank or order. In other words, I'm number one, and the rest come after me. It means that there is nobody else. It's not that God is chairman of the board of a pantheon of gods, or he is the leader of the pack, or head of the hierarchy, but it means that in my presence, in his presence, there is nobody else. Now, when you read the Ten Commandments, the Ten Commandments have a lot of instructions for good basic living. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, don't commit adultery. We follow those things, life actually goes easier. The first two have nothing to do, or maybe they do, with our everyday lives. But why did God put those first two in? Why does he care? I mean, he knows he's the only God, right? I mean, he knows there's nobody else. So is God insecure? Is he like a jealous husband who can't stand his wife talking to another man because he's nervous about what if she likes him more, or the other way around? But I think God actually has told us why the first two commandments, why there should be no one else before me. And we talked about jealousy. Is jealousy a desirable trait? Well, if I'm jealous, it's not really desirable. Do not worship any other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. God even calls himself Jealous. He says, that's my name. We don't think of that as a name of God. You know, we go, Wonderful Counselor, Almighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. Jealous? But that's because we don't understand what the concept of jealousy is. And the word jealous has at its same root zealous. Change a letter, new word. And that root word for that means intensely red. And I don't mean blushing as in I'm embarrassed, but it means I'm getting fired up, I'm getting upset, I'm getting, you know how your eyes bulge and your neck veins pop out and you start getting red and you are so passionate about something. I don't mean anger, but passion. And this word that's jealous is used only of God and only in reference to his relationship with us. So God is passionate about his relationship with us. And in Exodus 20, at the time that the commandments were written in through Old Testament times, idolatry was equated with adultery. The nation of Israel was the bride of God. And we talk about the church as being the bride of Christ. And we talk about the wedding feast. And someday we will be united with our groom. And we are the bride of Christ. And these phrases are used. And so, you know, if Gail was to call me up at work and say, I'm going out on a date tonight. And I said, fine. And she came home after her date with some guy, and I said, how'd your date go? And she says, oh, we had a great time. If you were to witness that, you would think we're both nuts, because there's not to be another woman in my life apart from her, and there's not to be another man in my life apart from another man in my life apart from. Okay, whatever. You got the idea. So God burns with passion for us. Just think about that for a minute. The creator of the universe burns in passion for each one of us. Not just that he likes us. Not just that he, these guys are nuts. They're dumb. They're, what are we going to do? Like, you know, the Trinity. Okay, what are we going to do now? Okay. No. We rebelled, and he pursued us with intense passion, even to the point of saying, I will give my son, and he will be rejected and die on the cross and be buried, and he will rise again from the dead. And that's how deep my passionate love is for my children. And they better not have anybody else in their life that they love like me. And that's what idolatry is talking about. And that's why God starts our lives, how he wants us to live our lives, by saying, I love you so much that I don't want anybody else sharing that love. There is room for nothing else in your heart except for me. And if we think of idolatry as adultery, and we think of God as the wild lover, and us and everything else that we seek after as less wild lovers, lesser lovers, but sometimes things make a little more sense in our brains, at least in mine. Maybe I don't think like everybody else. No other gods, no self-made gods. So what's that about? Okay, come back to that. Why would God say that? There is a reason. Is it because he's going to compete with a piece of wood if we think of idolatry as something carved? Well, Isaiah 40 has that humorous thing about, or is it 42? I've forgotten. Where the guy gets a tree and he cuts it down and he cuts a section of it and he carves an idol, and then he takes the rest of the tree and he builds a fire and he cooks his food on it, and then he thanks the other part of the tree for making the fire and giving him his food. And God points to the illogic of that. But that's not the idols that we make. How do we make gods? So the first question is, what is worship? That's the first question we have to think about. Second is, what do we want a god to do? I mean, have you ever thought about that? What do we expect a god to do? Not what do we expect God to do, what do we expect a god to do? And where do these gods come from? So first is, what is worship? The first question is not, what do we worship? We are hardwired as human beings to worship. One writer, last name's Kreeft, said it's not the opposite of theism is not atheism. The opposite of theism is idolatry. You either worship God or you worship other things. The other things you worship just happen to change over time. The author of this book, Gods at War, Kyle Eidelman, worship is the built-in human reflex to put your hope in something or someone, then to chase after it. You hold something up, then give your life to pursuing it. And to go on in his book, that's what human beings do, right alongside breathing and eating and thinking. We identify things we want, both good and bad, then we make sacrifices to get them. From the time we're born and introduced to milk, we are forever pursuing what we think will satisfy our appetites. You may not realize, but that's what you do. Another author I read says, we are looking for life. We spend our lives looking for life, for what will give us life. The end result, of course, is that our lives begin to take the shape of what we care about most. We each make the choice to worship, and then at some point we discover that the choice makes us. The object of your worship will determine your future and your life. It's a lot to digest. I don't expect anybody to digest that right now, but maybe it will start your thinking process. What do we want a god to do? That's probably something you never really thought about. I thought about it. So I have a couple of things. First of all, we want him to comfort us. We're having a bad day. We want something to comfort us. We come home after whatever, you know. I'm talking to people about their weight. You stop and get gas. You go in to pay your bill at Becker's. The chocolate bars are 2 for $1 or something or other. As I say to people, nobody ever buys 2 to take 1 home to the kiddies at home. they're buying two and they're going to eat them between getting the gas and getting home because they're looking for something to comfort them. Supply our current and future needs. That's what we want a God to do. Give us security, peace, transcendence. We want something to give us a purpose. You may not realize that, but we are all searching for these things every minute of every day. I have a chocolate lab. A chocolate lab spends every minute of every day looking for something to eat. It's hardwired. So this morning, Gail and I were cutting corned beef to make sandwiches. So Gail cooked a corned beef, and I was slicing it. I guess because I'm a doctor, I should be able to cut things. Doesn't always work out. Anyhow, the dog is waiting and waiting and waiting for something to fall off the floor. So we know if we leave anything on the counter, when we come home, he will have consumed it. It doesn't matter what it is or even the volume. We spend every moment of every day looking for these things, whether it's unconscious or conscious. And where do these gods come from? Well, Joshua, at the end of his life, said to the children of Israel as he was leading them, "You've got to make a choice." We're going to read that section, but what's interesting is he gives them a multiple choice. You get to choose A, B, C, D. Fortunately, he didn't say A, B, B, C, A, whatever those multiple choice that are so difficult, but we're going to read this. "Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods of your ancestors, worship beyond the Euphrates River and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living." So he gives them choices, and you may not realize that there's four choices in that section that he said. You have to pick. And then Joshua made that statement that we always think about. He says, "Today, my house and I have chosen the Lord." The gods your ancestors worship beyond the Euphrates. Abraham was taken from Ur of the Chaldees, the other side of the Euphrates, and we know that his family were idolaters. And he was brought first to Haran and then to the Promised Land. So they said, leave the gods of your ancestors, or you have a choice. You could choose to follow the gods of your ancestors or the gods that you worshipped in Egypt. There were some there who were raised in Egypt. I think it was those who were 20 and over were dead, those who were younger than 20. But there were gods from Egypt that followed them into the Promised Land. Or the gods of the land they're going into. That's the gods of the Amorites. So they're going into a land. Well, they've actually been in the land. They've conquered the land as best as they were going to. And there were gods there. They had to choose whether they're going to follow those or the true God. Each one of those categories represents a time in our life. And as Christ followers, we say, well, we're not idolaters. We follow God, but we're not immune from it. And this is something that's important. Things that are gods start as neutral. They're not gods until we give them the meaning and the purpose and the part in our life that God should have. When we give things that, then that's when it becomes a god. So all the things that we may think of, the story about the chocolate bars, you know, food. Food becomes a god when we turn to it for what God should be supplying in our life. Money becomes a god when we turn to it for what God should be supplying in our life. The gods of your ancestors. Well, that's our, could be our culture. We come from different cultures. Of course, we always think our culture is the correct one. I remember being in Emerge when I had to work Emerge 20-some years ago, or 30, if I'm honest. We all took turns working Emerge, and I remember being there when a man who was probably 65 was brought in. He was VSA, vital signs absent, and at that time we did CPR, and we did thought we were going to help. And I mean, this guy was dead before he got there, so I didn't knock him off. But so we spent half an hour on him, came out, and there were two sons who were probably in their 20s, and I said, "Sorry, Dad's gone." Well, one son runs in and starts pounding on Dad's chest, and the other son starts yelling his head off at me, telling he's going to call every lawyer he knows, the hospital is going to be brought to its knees, I will be killed, and all of these things. And I'm standing there, and I've never gone through this before in my life. And one of the nurses, after this barrage, came over, and the one son, about 5 minutes later, had quit pounding on his dad's chest. And everybody kind of calmed down. She said, and she mentioned this particular ethnic background. She says, "Well, you've never had a death from," and she mentioned this ethnic background. And I thought, well, you know, my particular background would be, "Oh, I'm sorry, Dad's dead. I guess you did the best you could." And that would be it. Now, what's right and what's wrong? Neither is right or wrong. They're just different things. But we always think our way is right. The things we adopted from our parents, and Gail and I were talking about this, and something very important in anything I say along those lines are, and it will be true for my kids, it's not what I said to my kids or what they saw in me, it's the messages they took from it. Because my interpretation of how it was and my interpretation of what my parents were doing is real to me and has affected my life. So we talked about security, and I was raised where being safe and secure, that's not a bad thing. Being able to provide for yourself, not a bad thing. But I took the message of that, that that was paramount. And that's shaped how I conduct myself. The priorities of our parents. You know, maybe Gail and I have talked about this before. There's nobody here who hasn't done this, had the fight on the way into church, right? Whatever. You're not talking by the time you get here. Well, for us, that could be true because it's 45 minutes. If you're 5 minutes away, your fight won't get that developed. But we've arrived at the point where we're no longer talking. We get out, greet people. "Oh, how are you?" "I'm fine." Right? Because we're never going to say, "Well, let me tell you about what happened on the way in." Well, first of all, because we're embarrassed by it by that point. But the second thing is, we got to keep the appearance up. And what the face we show of our family is so important. And that can become a god. You know, was your dad a sports fan? Was your mom, I don't know, into shopping? But that's something to think about. The gods you worshipped in Egypt. We don't realize until you're willing to start looking at your life that we have developed a way that we view life and the way that we deal with life based on our life experiences. And we have developed things that we turn to for comfort and for dealing with stress and for security and habits. But what's even, so here's, I've listed some things. They could be true for some of us or for all of us. Porn is something. Anger is something. You never thought of anger as being a way of dealing with things or something you turn to for comfort, but it sure is if you're an angry person. Food, control. Exerting control. You know, that's how you dealt with whatever. You know, I'm dating myself, but I used to love watching Law and Order, Criminal Intent. And it's still on some TV stations, so I will find those stations and watch an episode. And it's amazing, you know, the people who keep their desks perfectly controlled, you know, everything is in its spot. And mine's not like that. But everything's in its perfect spot. And maybe that's how they learn to deal with their childhood. So these are things that are the gods of Egypt that we bring into our adulthood. Our personality. I never thought that was something. But that's how we learn to deal with things. The gods of the land you're going into, our culture. What does our culture worship? Well, we could easily list some things. And, you know, sometimes it's the God of our ancestors, and we have commented about, at least in my own life, I know how to be a 20th century evangelical white Christian, because that's the culture I was brought up, and that's the culture I assume is correct, but may not have any bearing to real Christianity, but that's the culture I'm going to defend. Sex, money, power, fame. So how do we decide what is our God? All gods require sacrifice. So what are we sacrificing ourselves for? Our time, our money. I was glad to hear Mike taking the girls to the mission a while ago. I was kind of shamed. My mother-in-law, every time she goes shopping, buys something for the food bank. And I really felt shamed by that. And so I consciously started donating to a different mission. I didn't know this one existed, the Windsor Mission, and to the Salvation Army Drug Rehab Center here in Windsor. And just made a conscious effort to do that because I thought that's what I should do. But Gail and I were talking about this the other day. People might consider us generous, but we have never made a gift that was sacrificial. I've never been sacrificial in my giving. I've never given to where it hurt. So where do I sacrifice my finances? I've never actually sacrificed them for God. Where do I turn to for sanctuary, for comfort? You do this exercise, you start realizing where the gods are in your life. So this guy in this book, Kyle Idleman, says pleasure, power, love. He's divided gods into those categories. And it's an interesting read if you are interested in looking at your life. And if it's you're not interested in that, and if you're interested in the status quo and maintaining the way you are, you'll read it and say, oh, that guy's full of hot air. Or you won't even, or you'll read about who it applies to, somebody else, but not yourself. This is something that is very, very important. Our old gods won't go away without a fight. See, they're not inert. They are what Satan uses to defeat us. They're what Satan uses to keep us from being what God wants us to be. Money and power and sex are not inert. They will fight to regain control of your life. So Joshua gave four choices. Choose you this day whom you're going to serve. And he didn't give one of the choices of none of the above, because there isn't a none of the above. Now, the tragic thing is we think that we follow God. When I say we, I would say me. I think that I follow God, but I'm dragging along a whole bucket load of idols with me. So Jesus took the disciples in front of those idol temples, and he says, "Who do men say I am, and who do you say you are?" He made them choose in the presence of idolatry. I think there was a reason he did that. In 1 Kings chapter 18, Elijah told the nation of Israel to choose, and we're going to read that next week when I speak again. And Joshua said, "Choose." Matthew 12 has a kind of a funny little story there. But the idea is, you don't just kick an idol out, you got to replace it. Because if you don't, it's never going away. We do choose. Unfortunately, this is the choice we sometimes make. Now, I know this scripture specifically speaks to the northern kingdom when they were taken away into captivity, and the Assyrians brought people in to resettle. And if you read that in Kings, people came in who were foreigners to resettle, and lions came and started eating them. And they said, "What should we do?" And they said, "Well, we're worshiping the wrong God." So they brought the God of Israel back in, but they worshiped the God of Israel and their other gods. And I think that's sometimes where we are. We just aren't even aware of it. And Jesus, in his only real speech about idolatry, and it's interesting, he's talking about money. You can't serve two masters. You either serve one or the other. Sorry. So next time I speak, we're going to talk about what do we do next. We're going to talk a little bit more about what the idols are in our life. Let's close in prayer. Father, unless we are willing to search our lives and to look for where we are turning for what you supply, we will continue to share our heart with others. You want to be our lover and not share our heart with anyone else. Father, show us how to recognize where we are turning to for the things that you said you would supply. Show us how to recognize that. Give us the courage to recognize that. Give us the strength to deal with it. And show us how you will fill those voids that we are filling with other things. Thank you, Lord Jesus, that you have taken up residence in our hearts, that you have given us a new heart. Amen.